Conestoga Podcast, program 35 for Thursday, September 20th, 2007. I've interviewed a number of artists for the Conestoga Podcast, and I'm never quite sure what to expect, but they always turn out well. So when I sat down to talk with David Lee Anderson, I had no idea that he was such a talented musician. Of course, all that really says is that I should have researched my guest a little more thoroughly before interviewing him. Anyway, here's David. Welcome to the Conestoga Podcast. Today I have artist David Lee Anderson, who also substitutes as a musician as well. Welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me here. It's nice for an artist to talk about their art on the radio.
Yeah. I don't know if we'll be able to. It's going to be kind of difficult to talk about your art. You know, well, that's a really nice picture. I wish you guys could see this. This man has done so much for this convention, and we want to thank him publicly for all the work he has done to help Conestoga out over the years.
Well, thank you.
You started our story illustration workshop. You have been the narrator for the masquerade for more years than I can count. I think prior to Conestoga, you were at OCON.
Starting about 1988.
Wow, that's quite a ways back. And then also you helped us out with our art track when Kelly Vandiver left us. And you've also been our artist guest of honor in 99 and our fan guest of honor in 2003.
That's because they couldn't think of what else to do with me.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll make you Toastmaster some year. I don't know. So
that would be a good job for me.
Okay, cool. Well, I will suggest it at the next ConCom if the person they have already asked says no. So anyway, here's to them saying no. Let's see. As I've said, you've been a fixture of Conestoga for many years. You said that you've been doing the emceeing for the play and the masquerade since '88. How did you get roped into that?
Actually, I was talked into it by Susan Satterfield, who had somebody drop out at the last minute or couldn't do it, and she asked me if I would do it about an hour before the masquerade started. And I said, of course I would be happy to do it. And so a part of the deal was this narrator in the play. When they write the plays, they're spoofs of usually science fiction TV shows or movies, and they're extremely funny. But the advantage I had was that I didn't have to memorize any lines since they were all written down. And I ad-libbed quite a lot because well, that's just the way I am. I kind of got into it and, in fact, got an award for the most juvenile presentation of an adult.
Well, that your ad-libbing works really well with the play because, well, they ad-lib a lot of it. And I know Roger, he's writing it up to the last minute. I asked him today, is it done? He said, well, as done as it's going to get. So
until tomorrow,
which he's going to
add some more lines.
So I've got to get him on the podcast because that play is just, well, I don't know. You just have to be there sometimes. It's pretty good stuff. Now, I was doing a little research, and I couldn't find a whole lot of information about you because I found just a few short blurbs. All the other people I was interviewing, there was just tons of material, so you're almost a blank slate to me, so which I guess is, although I've seen your artwork, it's just pretty amazing stuff.
Well, I don't let a lot of information out about me. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, I keep it real tight. So, man of mystery, well, artist of the unknown.
Well, you have been president of ASFA, and if you could tell us a little bit about your tenure of that, would be very interesting. How all that works.
Well, ASFA, the Association for Science Fiction and Fantasy Artists, is a national artist organization, and because many artists are incapable of taking direction and or organizing themselves. It's a very loose term applied to it. I say organization in the broader sense that people would try to understand what that's about. But artists, I think B. Joe Trimble said something about fans being getting artists together is like herding cats, that it just – was a thankless job. The pay wasn't any good, and results, I should say, was that we've got some national trends going for standardizing art shows. The artists have improved relations with publishers, and we had quite a bit of groundwork that made the shows much more professional after many years. But the artist organization itself was interesting to run on a national scale because all of the regions have different problems. And the East Coast shows are a lot older. There's many of them that are going on 40, 50 years that they've been doing conventions, and they like doing things their own way, and the West Coast has their own way of doing things. And they refer to us from Oklahoma and in the middle part of the country as the wimpy zone, because there's not that many. There are a lot of artists and writers from this area, but there's not the numbers of fans that there are on the East and West Coast. So it was I was referred to for many years as the artist from Oklahoma, as if that was some sort of sign of my bravery at showing up in the East and West Coast conventions. But ASFA itself has run, let's see, I think it's going on 30 years, and there's a. It's just amazing that I was in on some of the groundwork, although it had already been. It started, I think, in 1976 originally, and I was the president in 90 to 92, and my friend, good friend David Cherry, was the president prior to me, and he lived in Oklahoma as well. So we actually kind of established the center of a lot of things that were happening in ASPA were from the wimpy zone. So.
Yeah, well, I think I would take exception to that. Robin Wayne Bailey, who I interviewed last year, he, you know, being president of CIFWA, Science Fiction Writers of America, he said something similar about herding cats, except it was more like herding ants.
Oh.
And then under his breath, he said, piss ants. So
that sounds like something Robin would say.
And I have it on tape, yeah. So you can always go back and listen to that podcast. Well, okay, well, that's fascinating. I suppose we ought to talk about a little bit about your art and about the Illustrator's Workshop, because I think you know, a lot of aspiring artists, you know, they want to break into the field to be able to do covers and sell their artwork and do interior illustrations. And if you could give us a rundown of how the Illustrator's Workshop works and what its purpose is.
Well, the Illustrator's Workshop is it's a very fun thing to do because it's a hands-on 2-hour workshop that we actually get some drawings done. The basic thing is to sketch an idea from a story that's given to us. And last year we had Don Mates, who is an amazing cover artist, just a legend, actually. And he was in there just sketching away just like everybody else, had great advice for people. He was commenting on all of the attempts at illustration, and I think it's basically that we're doing sketches, but they're preliminaries to ideas, and that's how all of us artists work. We all, you know, start out with a preliminary sketch, with thumbnail sketches is what we call them, and but the idea is the seed, and that's the thing that makes the painting work later. So it's actually the germ of the idea, and that whole thing is really exciting. And so we have quite a few people show up with different talents. Some are more comic book artists. Some are illustration or painters. And some people are interested in just what the heck's going on and just try their hand at it. So what we do is we have a short story that we have everybody read. It's usually only about 2 or 3 pages. And we have all the artists work on different sketches, and we can have enough time to actually do a somewhat finished sketch, because what we're trying to have you do, as I taught illustration for many years, and the idea is to get the thumbnail sketch, do about two or three or four of them, you know, because this is the way we approach cover. When we do a cover assignment, we do color sketches, which is several different versions of ideas for
right.
from the story. And in this particular case, since it's a short, there's not often that many images that you can draw on, but at the same time, it can be very done very quickly and very precise. So Don Mates did a wonderful concept drawing, and it was not a literal, it was more of a figurative, abstract almost, a translation of the idea, but it was still just a wonderful summation of the whole story, and that's what we're aiming for.
Okay. Well, when you're taking that story, and particularly when you're doing a cover for a book or an illustration for a short story, you know, you get the material to read, and then you decide, you know, what's going to inspire you to create that image that's going to be representative of the story. Do you find that it some stories, you know, you nail it and you can get something right away, or some you just have to think about it a long time before you come up with something that's going to work for the story?
Well, I think part of my job, and for years, is instantly coming up with imagery that sometimes it's not particularly good for a cover, but I do interior illustrations like for Isaac Asimov's magazine, and sometimes you don't need what would be the kind of advertising thing that you need for a cover. For an interior illustration, it can be a smaller, more intimate representation, and in many cases is quite different than what a cover would be. And so you kind of aim for since it's a small story, you just try to aim for an interior illustration style, you know, which is somewhat more intimate, I guess. An image comes to mind instantly for me. In some cases, there are stories that my friend Del Harris referred to as people talking in a room. There are many of Isaac Asimov's novels and so on are people having conversations about large ideas, but
uh-huh.
there's not much imagery to bring, you know, to a viewer in the sense that a reader would see one interpretation. And that's what I think is so interesting about story illustration, is that we have 13 people in the room, and there are often 13 completely different concepts of the same material. That's what's so interesting about the ideas, you know, that when you generate them and then you're all, you know, kind of sharing and looking at each other's work. And oftentimes I think of something else, another idea that's a combination of those two elements
mm-hmm.
from what somebody else has done. You know, so it's very interesting to see what people come up with.
Now, when you're doing artwork that you've been commissioned to do, obviously there's a lot of trade-offs. You have to, you know, you want to have something that's going to help sell the book, but you also want to satisfy your own artistic, I don't know what the word I want to say, to satisfy yourself, and then also to help please the author and the editor. Do you see that as a balancing act, or is it you just go to it?
I try to do more literary interpretation of an illustration that could cover all those bases, but it's not possible to balance out the person who is buying the work from you, buying the rights to use it, actually, is the person you have to please, and that's the art director. Art director often is at odds with the editor over what imagery is used, and so many times covers can be very confusing as to what they're trying to get across, because there's a lot of art that I've done in the past that has been used that they call stock art. It's just traditional space paintings with spaceships and planets in the background and space stations or shuttles or that sort of thing. And many times they'll choose one of those for a cover because it represents the idea. Perhaps it's a story collection. It's not an exact story, or it's not an illustration from a story in the collection, but it has the idea of near future space or far future space or something. An example is the covers that were done for Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game. Those were all stock art illustrations by an artist named John Harris, and they were chosen for their ambiguous look, that they didn't have any scene in the book. The artist had done the paintings many years before the book was published,
uh-huh.
but the publisher chose those because it looked like a big space book, you know. And I later did an illustration for Ender's Game where I used the character Ender in these gaming setups and so on. And Orson Scott Card saw the illustration, and he said he would have preferred something more literary. But Tor, who was publishing the book, had the idea that these were going to sell more if they didn't have a specific scene out of the book.
Yeah, you were talking about stock art. I was looking at your website, looking at some of the various paintings and illustrations that you have online, and the one that caught my eye was the one that was a cover. I think it was a stock art you did for Paul Anderson, mm-hmm. and you had a comment on there how both of you had shared the same last name, and that might have been a first, that the artist and the author.
Anderson is such a common name that it's not unlikely that it's happened before, but the fact that Paul Anderson and David Lee Anderson did, you know, a book together. In fact, I was invited to a convention in Omaha because they thought I was related to him. And it was an advantage to me, but, you know, it was a son Paul hadn't known he had. The stock art itself was done many years before the book was published, and it was also used for an L5 poster. L5 was a space promotions organization that was incorporated into the National Space Society.
Yeah, I remember the L5 in 95. We're about 12 years past that now.
Yeah, actually, when I did that, it was from McDonnell Douglas Designs, mm-hmm. and you know, I used some elements of other photographs together and made this painting, and it was in 84, and we thought for sure that there would be a space station by 95, and of course the Challenger accident put that back, and the various complications of getting an international space station together were far more complicated. So you know, I had this space station painting that for many years people thought that was a photograph of what was up there. We didn't have a space station yet, but I have done recently many versions of the International Space Station, mainly because it's such a tinker toy apparatus that they keep putting it together every year. I have, you know, a different view of the space station, so it's turned out to be pretty lucrative for me.
Well, that's excellent. Yeah, I think we're all fair, because I was in the L5 in the early days, and I think we're all rather naive as to what we hoped to achieve. But there are other successor organizations, I think we'll get there. It just may take a little longer than we anticipated. I think we're going to go ahead and change tack a little bit. Mm-hmm. We do have a fair amount of time left, but I just discovered that David Lee Anderson is a musician. When he walked in the room with a guitar, and I thought, cool, we'll get to have some music. You're going to be playing a live song from your Star Cruisers CD, or Maroon, what's the title?
Yes, the name of the group is Star Cruisers.
Ah, okay.
And it's a cosmic rock band. We play hard rock. They're all songs that I have written. I had met for many years, have played music, but it wasn't until the last couple of years that I got together with some musicians who wanted to play space-themed rock. I never really had done space theme before, but I fit into it since I had been involved in science fiction as an illustrator for 27 years now. Mm-hmm. So, but I had been writing songs, probably starting in the early 70s, and I played in rock bands since the early 70s.
Wow.
And so I just decided it was time to kind of incorporate both of those artistic urges, I guess. And besides, the cover art is cheap from, you know, since...
You get to do your own.
I do my own. But I have a song that I can do that I can remember all the words to called Space Pirates.
Okay. Well, why don't we play a few chords, and that way we get the audio level, and okay. Then we'll make sure that we got it for recording for the rest of the podcast
okay.
here. I think that'll work.
Okay.
Okay, great. Okay. So tell us a little bit about this song, and then I'll let you go to it.
This is a song called Space Pirates, and it was... inspired by a group called Flaming Lips, our national group from Oklahoma City, that do kind of weird psychedelic folk rock, I guess you could call it. But they're an inspiration, at least to me, in the kind of using the acoustic for this particular one. A lot of the other songs that we do are electric or hard rock songs, so this is one of those that's more folk based.
Scourge among the spacelings, you should know. Band of cutthroat scurvy thieves try to steal the show. If you blunder into them and escape with just your skin, you'd be very fortunate that they didn't do you in. Space pirates cross the seven stars. Space pirates round Jupiter and Mars. Space pirates, they'll rob your treasure stash. Space pirates, they'll even take your cash. Beware of little asteroids lurking round the ring. You among the crowd of little moonlight things. Put a shot across your bow, then they try to board. Don't be brave and try to save your precious little hoard. Space pirates cross the seven stars. Space pirates round Jupiter and Mars. Space pirates, they'll rob your treasure stash. Space pirates, they'll even take your cash. What do you do with a drunken cyborg? What do you do with a drunken cyborg? What do you do with a drunken cyborg early in the morning? What do you do with a drunken cyborg? What do you do with a drunken cyborg? What do you do with a drunken cyborg early in the morning? Captain of the pirates is a gentleman named K. He's got one eye, he's got two horns and a cybernetic leg. His first mate is a cyborg with handle Pac-Man red. He likes to steal and he likes to kill, and he'd rather see you dead. Space pirates across the seven stars. Space pirates round Jupiter and Mars. Space pirates, they'll rob your treasure stash. Space pirates, they'll even take your cash. Space pirates, space pirates, space pirates, space pirates.
That was amazing.
Resonant fade out.
Cool.
Well, as you can see, I don't write really serious lyrics to things. So,
well, that was
I'm not real serious most of the time.
I really enjoyed that. That was great. Let's see. What else can we talk about? I'm not sure we can really top that song. like I said, that was very good, and I really appreciate you playing it for me. And that's a first for the Conestoga podcast.
All right, all right. You guys have done many podcasts, and they're all interesting, I think.
Well, thank you. David, you know, again, I want to thank you for all the work that you've helped us out with Conestoga and your announcing for the Masquerade and the play. That's always entertaining, a lot of fun. And people, you have to come to this convention and see the play.
The play is the thing. In fact, they do the Masquerade so they can do a play.
Yep, they do. Well, David, thank you very much for joining us on the Conestoga podcast today.
All right. Well, thank you.
David Lee Anderson has been such a great supporter of Conestoga that we cannot thank him enough. We hope to have him back for many more. He can also be found at many other conventions supporting them and just being a great guest. I know he'll be at FenCon 4 this weekend, which is September 21st through the 23rd, 2007 in Dallas, Texas. Anyway, there's a good chance we may hear some more music from him in the future on this podcast. So thanks for listening. Until the next Conestoga podcast. No lemurs were harmed in the making of this podcast.